Today is June 24th, WWDC Week 2020. This is episode number 533 of the Apple Context Machine. That is a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm the Brian Chaffin. And listen, sometimes your volume is up, and sometimes stuff just hits you out of nowhere when you're least expecting it. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, you can shoot me a note over at macobserver.com/contextmachine. And that will take you straight to our Facebook group. Now, joining me this week is my very good friend, the lovely, lovely, lovely person, despite what you may or may not have read, John Keat.
Brian! Hello.
Hey, John.
Hello.
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 Hello. Are you there?
Is this on?
Are
Is
you
the
there?
Volume on?
You never call me anymore. Yeah, I'm fine. You're busy. I get it. You're busy. I'm Mr. Big Shot. That's fine.
How you doing, Brian?
Well, John, I am good. How are you
good.
Doing? How are you handling COVID-19?
Not good. It's fine here.
Are things kind of under control in New York?
The news, without getting too political, it always reminds me when I was back in New Jersey, they showed the floods, right? And the press liked to make it look worse than it was, right? So they find the one spot where there's a puddle and put a canoe in there, and there's three guys walking by in ankle-deep water.
Sure.
This isn't quite, you know, that. there are real things going on in the city, for sure. But things in life, I find things are never quite as bad or as good as many people make out to be. You got to kind of make your own assessment on that.
All right. Well, fair enough. I'm just glad that you're doing okay. I'm very, very glad to hear that. Now, this was, John, a busy week in the world of Apple.
Yes.
They did that whole... we hadn't planned on talking about this, but they did the WWDC thing. Actually, it's going on right now. My question to you is, because I don't think I've heard anything from you on this, is what did you think of the presentation of the quote-unquote keynote?
You know, considering the total lack of charisma and ability to present by anyone at Apple anymore, that they went to just this totally pre-packaged bubble wrapper can thing without the audience, I kind of liked it. It was tighter than the shows would otherwise be, and a little bit more focused because of it. So, yeah, I frankly wish they'd do it every year. I wonder if they worry about leaks of, you know, kind of the pre-canned production getting out. Hopefully they can keep that under wraps. But I didn't miss the live presentations at all because no one can speak without reading a teleprompter like a hostage during those presentations, faking the amazing excitement they have during the entire thing. It's kind of sad. So did I damn it with faint praise enough?
No, not at all. Here was my big takeaway from it. And I said this on Ken Ray show, and I said this on TDO, but my big takeaway was that Apple had the courage, and I hate to use that word considering Phil's gross misuse of it once upon a time, but had the courage to actually make a show for the medium as opposed to just like trying to reproduce, you know, a normal keynote without an audience. They did stuff differently, right? I mean, they made a different show that was specific for the way everything was being presented, which was, of course, by video with no one in person, and they brought a lot of production value to it, and I think it would have been a lot easier to, you know, fake an audience or like just pretend there is an audience there or do a bunch of other things that Apple did not do. I think that like there are plenty of other tech companies that might have gone that route.
I didn't watch it, but the Technorati, who I have nothing but disdain for, went and lauded Snap's, as in Snapchat's, keynote and that it was an amazing production and that Steve Jobs, you know, has been, finally been outpaced by this amazing production. Now, the thought of watching a Snapchat keynote is somewhere in the realm of wanting to staple gun my hand to a stove. But from what I understand, it was kind of done because of COVID as well. So, you know, some of that, I think, is just simultaneously people were, I guess, getting good advice for with regard to PR and how they should do this. Nonetheless, I thought it was good just because I can't remember the last time I enjoyed a keynote that Steve Jobs wasn't involved in.
Yeah, fair enough. Although it was, I don't want to go down like this maudlin route, but it was sad seeing him on the last one and seeing how sick he was. It was both uplifting because he was there, and it was sad at the same time.
I totally agree. In retrospect, but it's funny that they can't find people. I know that Steve practiced a lot, but I think they mistake practice for rote, right? Just because he wasn't parroting or speaking kind of canned words that he had floating in his head. The practice was to know the material cold so he could talk any way he wanted about it.
And timing and positioning. Like, you know, right. I
agree. But do you remember when he did the Q&A at the hostile WWDC when he first came back and crazy questions that guy got? And he would sit and he'd make a pause and he'd talk. And it's not much different than the points he would make when he was doing a keynote. His kind of famous speech that we've got this model wrong, thinking that for us to win, Microsoft has to lose.
Yeah.
Right. That's the kind of stuff he would say off the cuff. And he did so when he talked about why they were killing CyberDog and all the libraries and stuff on the old Mac OS 9. And clearly he didn't prepare for that because the questions came from the audience at random. So the guy could speak well and he had passion for what he was doing and it oozed out of him in every way possible. And it's totally not fair to ask anyone to follow him up there, but it's just not totally unfair to ask that everyone stop reading ransom notes. Like it's a bad SNL sketch they couldn't prepare. This is all you do in your life. You sit in the bowels somewhere in Apple and do nothing but this. You should be able to talk about it. Not like you're a hostage. Honestly, you know, it's not asking that much.
I'm not anywhere near as critical of other executives' performances as you are, but it's absolutely the case that everybody else, that everything that Apple is doing on the keynote stage is now much more controlled. And I think it's speaking to what you're saying. I'm just putting it in nicer terms, you know, as I am wont to do. And I'm wondering where that comes from.
It comes from not having a delight for the product. Part of the thing that I think
Craig Federighi has a delight for his product.
Well, he's certainly not allowed to show it as much as Steve was. Steve clearly took, I remember the presentation he did at one of the Next Worlds when he was showing off the Alpha Channel on the Next Dimension. And he pulls out a Ferrari without, I mean, this is, you know, now it's not a big deal, but back then it was, I don't know, it was like parting the Red Sea kind of stuff in tech world. You know, he had this 3D cube, which we still don't have, by the way. He had real-time renderman running on this cube, rotating. And then he put Donald Duck in a forest behind it on one layer and a Ferrari with a window in another layer. And you could see the cube rotating through the Alpha Channel, semi-permeable. And you could tell the guy was delighting in showing. Yeah. Right. He was delighting in showing this. I don't get that sense at all. I see people standing up on the stage, delighting in where their career is taking them, delighting them in, wow, I can spin off and get into some startup and I might be CEO or whatever because of this position. They delight in a lot of things, but it's not the product. And frankly, the product is so kind of bleh at this point that maybe that's why. But it tells me something. Why is there not more delight in the product? Why has it become so antiseptic that there is no whimsy?
Who and had the delight, and delight? When other than Steve back in the day? I mean, you know,
a lot of the next team.
You see what I'm saying, right?
Yeah, I think the problem is, you know, I think Johnny definitely. I mean, I found a lot of his demeanor and his presentations to be, let's put it the nicest way I could put it is, kind of chaotic, but it's. But his passion to me was never questioned. The problem is he has a very austere sense of design, and I love a lot of that. But it was also balanced with other people that had more whimsy, right? Bill Atkinson had a lot of whimsy in him. He had a lot of delight for making magic happen. A little bit of almost like that. He was between him and Andy Hertzfeld. It was like...
Yeah, that's a fair point.
It was totally a fair point. Like the Spielberg productions of magic in the software world, and that is just completely dead at Apple at this point. And to me, in my opinion, I don't even remember the last time I saw some kind of magic whimsy come out of a product.
Okay, well, we've gone down a thoroughly dark and disgruntled path, so I will close that part of this discussion up by saying that I did think the presentation was absolutely fantastic. I thought they did a really good job. I thought there was a lot of production value, and I do applaud Apple for putting the right show together for the medium.
In so much as I bring my standards down to such unbelievably low depths for Apple that I would agree with you. Yes.
Right. So on that note, we were originally going to have the first segment actually be about Apple Silicon, i.e. Macs on ARM. So let's talk about that.
So while I'm not surprised they, you know, moved, I am surprised how early they announced and how aggressive the timetable is. The first product's supposed to be out in by the end of this year. So were you surprised at all by the kind of timetable of things?
Yeah, you know, I was kind of mixed on whether or not we would see it. I mean, the rumors had that sort of strength behind them.
Yep.
That usually indicates validity. But yep. At the same time, it did seem like it was kind of aggressive. Now, let me throw this at you. Is this seemingly aggressive timetable in part because Apple is using last year's chip, year and a half ago's chip, the 12?
Oh, a little bit like when they had to slow Mac operating system updates to concentrate on iPhone stuff, kind of. Because Apple, of course, is an impoverished company that doesn't have enough resources to chew bubblegum and walk at the same time, right?
Yes.
That's the
reason. Well, no, I mean that it's not as aggressive because this chip is from 2018, really. That's when the 12X came out. And this is, so Apple's using the 12Z. Although wait a minute. I may be still wrong on this. So first of all, when I do live coverage on a keynote event, a lot of times the details don't stick because I'm having to write so fast.
Sure.
And it's in and out, you know, garbage, not garbage in, but information in, information out through my fingers, and I've got to move on to the next thing. And a lot of times I'm typing what was just said while something new is being said, and I've got to be able to like constantly be in two places at once. Now, my understanding is that the first Macs were going to ship with the 12Z. But then someone corrected me and said, no, that's just the developer.
That's just a developer build. We have no idea what the first Macs are going to ship with. I would imagine it would be the 13 or 14 something, or what they might have a whole new naming category for this stuff.
But it could be the 12Z.
Could be. It could be. I don't think it will be, but you're right. It could be. It's an absurdly low power chip. It kind of breaks... You know, we could have Macs. If you put that level chip, the same thing that's in an iPad, in a Mac with a battery that's, you know, whatever, 2x the size of it, all of a sudden we could have battery life approaching 24 hours. I mean, like, insane things start to be possible.
Right. Okay, but my point is that maybe this is part of the aggressive timetable. They're not like, even if it's just a developer kit, they're not shipping a 13Z or a 14Z. 14Z isn't likely at all, but they're not shipping a Series 13. Instead, they're shipping a chip that they could well have been working on since 2018 or 2017, really.
I just don't know what to say about it. Unlike when I was right and you were wrong about the Mac Pro coming out not having ARM in it, just because the Xeons are not the place to start. There are so many possibilities with everything from the Mac Mini all the way up to even an iMac, on just based on what they currently have as being interestingly possible, that I don't think that there's stronger weight. There's such a strong weight where I'd have confidence to bet one way or the other. So what you say is possible, and it would make for a very reasonable product. I mean, it would make for a product that is not as high on the power side, but plenty powerful, but that would have obscene efficiency on battery usage. It would just be crazy.
It could be crazy. But, you know, at the same time, it seems like Apple needs to be doing multi-cores.
Well, they already have it, right? Isn't like the 12Z, I think it's like a 6 or 8 core machine already. And then it's like eight core GPU. So it's
the 12Z is 8 cores. The 12X was 7 cores.
Yeah. When you still have, I think, Mac Pros with 2 cores, right?
Right.
I think on the low end 13 inch, you still have 2 cores, right? We could check while we speak here. Assuming that's the case, any one of the, you know, as a bottom line chip, that would be an amazing upgrade for the low end.
I'm checking the current specs of the 13 inch. Quad core. They actually start.
They start all the way at quad core. Okay. Yeah. But still, it would have more cores than even the quad. I think we're talking the 12Z, I think, has... 12Z, how many cores does it have? 12Z core.
We're looking. Sausage being made. Da-da-dum. How many cores does...
8 core. So it's an 8 core chip. I'm sorry, it's an 8 core GPU, right?
Yeah, it's an 8 core GPU.
And...
And
an 8-core and an 8-core CPU. It has 4 big ones and 4 little ones. High power per little bit.
That's right.
So it already is going to be more powerful than even the baseline Mac Pros. I'm sorry, the MacBook Air, I think, still comes with
yes.
So if you put one of these in a MacBook Air, it obliterates it. It just destroys it. And it makes sense in an Air, right? Like, this will be way less power hungry than what's in a current Air. And it makes sense if they ever bring back the 12-inch MacBook as well.
I wonder if they will. I never understood the need for the MacBook with the MacBook Air out there.
I liked it because it was just the most compact size possible with still a full-size keyboard. And I bet you with a smaller bezel today, you could do that same machine with a 13-inch screen. If they ever shrink the bezels more on the lower end machines.
Yep. Yeah, it could be. So all in all, like, how do you think they're going to address power on at the Mac Pro level, which isn't coming out? Like, there's no announcement yet on Mac Pro on Apple Silicon.
Well, there are 80 core ARM chips out currently for servers. So we know what's possible, at least out in the industry. Now, that it's a far cry from what they're currently doing to ramp up to an 80 core chip, and I have no idea what the power usage on it is, but they have a huge advantage in their relationship with Taiwan Semiconductor, right?
Yeah.
TSMC, or whatever the initials are in that. Taiwan Semiconductor is the only other entity other than the Apple chip design team that are just magicians. They're going, they're already at 7 nanometer, which is amazing. It's insane. I think 7 nanometer means that the pathways for the chips, the circuitry pathways, are 14 atoms wide.
Yep.
14 atoms wide. And they have announced they're working towards the 5 nanometer for one of the next releases of Apple's chips. So I guess the A14 is supposed to there's a chance it will go down to 5 nanometers. And they have announced that they're working on trying to get a 3 nanometer build
that's
a few years
right
later.
Right up at the limits of what it should theoretically be.
6 possible. Atoms wide. Well, let's put it this way. After you get down to, we know what the actual limit is. It's 0.5 nanometer, right? Because that's one atom.
Okay,
you can't have zero atoms, right? So it's literally 0.5 nanometer is where this all stops, and we need some kind of other process to do this. But yeah, 3 nanometers is again mind-boggling because it will be 6 atoms wide that are doing the conduction. And this is what's really motivating, I think, the move from Intel to the Apple basically ARM-based platform, in that Intel is still stuck at 14 nanometers for the vast majority of its production. They're barely trying to creep up to 10 nanometers and really not doing a good job at it. Who knows when they'll actually get to 7 nanometers. By the time they do, Apple will more than likely be at 5 for all of its production, not some of its production, for all of its production. Whereas Intel may be lucky to get even a little bit of its production onto 7 nanometers. So Taiwan Semiconductor has done an amazing job on the physical fabrication. Apple's done an amazing job at the logical constructs of their chips and how efficient they are. And the combo together is just something that really is. Unfortunately, it's the kind of magic that only a super, you know, engineering geek would like, but it is miraculous what those two have done together. Just miraculous. And the move, and that's why I think the move is justified, because the low end, you know, MacBook Air will go from 2 cores to 8 cores and be just a monster with even better battery life, with not much work for Apple. And I'm sorry, I'm evading your other question, which is very on point. You know, when will the Mac Pro be updated? So personally, it makes me happy that I bought this, because I have some reasons to need Intel virtualization and other things that I think will continue to be superior on Intel processor for a while at least. But so there's a chance that this Mac Pro will be the last Intel-based Mac Pro. The first, well, not the first.
I think it's
really
not even a chance. I think it's definite.
Well, because if we use the last processor migration they had as a template for this, I think from when they released the first Intel Mac to when they converted the entire line to Intel only took about 9 months, right? But if we assume that they release a machine late this year, like they said they would, that's probably a December release. So it's only, you know, ostensibly this year. And then 9 months later, you're talking they would be done somewhere around the September, October timeframe to finish. The probable update time for the Mac Pro, I would think, would be somewhat early in 2021. If I don't even know if Nouzeon's released, but if you give it like a little bit more than a year's worth of time for the upgrade, that would be kind of the earliest side of things. And then if you're Apple, you have to be thinking, well, if we're planning on, you know, converting this 9 months later, why would we bother, right? Why would you bother to do it on an Intel just to within 9 months nuke it? And so this might be the last Intel processor. But there's also a chance that while they can upgrade, the difference with this migration from the PowerPC to Intel migration is a very big one, though. When Apple decided to migrate from PowerPC to Intel already had a full line of processors from the lowest end to the highest end. So they could just walk into an ecosystem that existed. Apple doesn't have that. Apple has kind of the low end to maybe the mid end made kind of just from iPhones and iPads. And they really haven't produced a high-end line with 80 cores or something like that. Maybe it's easy, maybe it's hard. I suspect it's hard when you get up to these huge silicon dies with like 80 cores and stuff like that. And it's not clear whether Apple would even have hyper-threading on their multi-core chips like Intel does. So they would probably want to present a chip with overwhelming number of cores. Like, it's not enough just to kind of meet parity. You'd want to like really...
Do you think Apple needs to beat performance, or is merely meeting it acceptable?
I think merely meeting it will become acceptable, but not initially. So the first machine they really need to show, here's our MacBook Air, we obliterate it, right? Kind of when you get to the mid-level, kind of the iMac and Mac Mini level, I think if you're in the ballpark, no one's going to care, right? Like, except I'm not talking about the high end of the
iMac. Yeah, I actually meant that question about the Mac Pro.
And when you get to the Mac Pro level, I think you need to have something that shows you are overjuicing it, because why, you know, kind of the enterprise market has been so burned so many times by this that going back to a custom chip, people really want to know, why is this worth my time? And the easiest answer, I'm not saying it's the best answer, but the easiest answer is, well, it's just way more powerful. I don't think anyone that has a Mac Pro gives a darn about power efficiency, right? We're running basically a space heater generator to it's a 1.4 kilowatt power supply on this monstrosity. So no one cares how efficient the power is. They just want power. So I think they do. Currently the state of the art are AMD 64 core chips. Intel is woefully behind with their, you know, pitiful Xeons, relatively. I don't know if by the time Apple is ready, does AMD go beyond its current 64 core set, or do they continue to refine it? My guess is they continue to refine the 64 core set for a while. So if they could come out with an 80-ish core or 128 core machine, that becomes super compelling, right?
It really, really
and
does.
Not to mention, this is where power efficiency actually makes a difference. The AMD is super efficient compared to the Intel. The Intel are just like nuclear melting, you know, disaster zones of power draw. But AMD has 7-nanometer 64 core chips, so they're just more energy efficient. You could imagine that Apple might be able to make an 80 or 128 core chip, and it's so little power draw relative to the competition. Maybe they can put in two of them, and that becomes, you know, earth moving kind of thing, to have 256 core potential, and then they could sell it for really a fraction of the cost of what Intel is charging for their Xeon line.
Yeah,
because it's all Apple's cost really on that. So there, I think that's the way to be compelling in that market. You just have to overwhelm them with actual processing grunt and then you just get, it just wipes away many other questions that the professionals will have.
But will, you know, Apple really hasn't seemingly consulted with us when it comes to which processors to use and stuff.
Right.
So my question is, will they actually do these things, or will they, you know, will they instead just say, well, you know, here's your Apple Silicon Mac Pro, you know, take it and eat some cake.
You know, it's not outside, I guess, some of their actions in the past, but you would think that they were so embarrassingly forced to make the current Mac Pro that they would learn that the Mac professionals really need horsepower, right?
Yeah, like, I hope so.
I think that was the big takeaway. Horsepower is needed by pros, period. Horsepower at all costs. And the costs are commensurate, apparently, if you do want that. But I think they got that message. There's a lot of more subtle messages I don't think they got about the Mac Pro and about enthusiasts and many other things. But that we need a lot of power, I think that message was finally received and understood.
Let's hope so. And I think so, too. I mean, I'm not actually cynical on this. I'm not actually expecting disappointment on this. I, though, however, would not be surprised if Apple ended up just doing a, you know, shipping a machine and then, like, people ran benchmarks on it and, you know, and we all found out that it was slower than the Intel machine. I'm not, that would not surprise me. I just don't expect it.
That would surprise me. And again, I think there is one other outcome that I haven't mentioned that's possible, where there would be a second Mac Pro with an Intel processor release, which is because of the difference that I stated from this migration to the past. In the first migration to Intel from PowerPC, we were moving to an ecosystem that was fully fleshed out and existing. Here we're coming to a new ecosystem is still being built by Apple with its processor line.
Yeah.
And because of that, they may have processors ready to go kind of from the low to the mid end, but once they get to the high end in the 60 and 100 core chips, they might be 2 years off from making that happen. And if that's the case, they might release one more.
I'd be shocked if they shipped it. You know, John, I think they're much more likely to just keep on shipping the same old machine like they've done in the past.
Right, and just let it run for 2.5 years until they actually have the replacement. I think you're right, but I think what you might see there that you didn't see last time is I don't think there will be a, maybe if it has to go for over 2 years, what they'll do is they'll just do a small processor bump, right? Like instead of 2.8 gigahertz, the new chips are 3 gigahertz or something like that.
And that would be good. If they do need to go 2 years and they did that, that would be fine with me. I can't, as long as it's not, you know, 2.5, 3-year-old technology. That's when I was getting cranky before. All right. So let's wrap this up. And all in all, Macs on Apple Silicon as announced with the roadmap announced, thumbs up or thumbs down?
Super thumbs up. I don't know why I'm so excited, but I am excited.
Me too, man.
I think it's good things. I think at the very least, to not have a laptop that's scorching my lap and that has a super long battery life is a very exciting thing. New York City agrees. And I just think other things on the software side, where I'll get to patting myself on my back, there's a lot of exciting things that can happen as well.
We're not there. All right. So the
Rosetta 2 compatibility layer is even more impressive than it was the first time. And
really?
Just from a technical standpoint, the first time it was much more interpretive. And in this version, they have some really clever things going on with kind of, they analyze your binary, right? And one of the problems that I have with software today is this horrible bloat, because nobody programs anything. They just call libraries of these bloated libraries. But there's a good part with that, because if you're calling a library, well, you can just call the recompiled library, right? And that does actually execute natively. So they can catch a lot of these calls, basically generate like a little cache executable bundle. And a lot of the code ends up still running native, because it's so much based on library calls, which is super clever stuff. Although if you were a bad black hat programmer, you can imagine, you know, like injecting stuff into that stuff, but I digress. And so in addition to kind of the interpretive stuff that Rosetta did in the first time, it's doing that. So the speed up on some of these, you know, ostensibly interpreted applications through Rosetta is really kind of crazy. And I think it showed in a lot of the demos. Of course, you know, they're demos, so you can't fully believe it. But I do believe that this is much better tech than the first time around. And the first time around, it was magical, right? So you didn't even know you were using it. It was so good. So, yep. I was really, really blown away by how good, and at least the roadmap is. We'll see how the execution is.
Right. Right. Well, and they have their own, speaking of roadmap, they have their own map. They're very successful map of how to do this. So I have very, very good and high expectations for Rosetta 2.
Not quite.
Yeah, not quite, right? Okay. So now we're both thumbs up-y on the whole Mac on Apple Silicon. Yep. We're both thumbs up-y on Apple's potential here. So let's do, even though it seems like a lot of that segment was still complaining, let's go ahead and do some whining. And I know that you're really cranky about this. Apple announced, was it just one of the sessions that revealed this?
Yeah, it was just one of the sessions revealed that kind of the way that the boot manager will work on new Macs is going to be different. And so a lot of it I actually applaud, because they're kind of, you know, we us old time Mac-er people, we remember the, you know, the command S is single user mode and command R during boot, it gets you into recovery mode, and command option P and R reset the parameter RAM and blah, blah, blah. There's like a bajillion, an option booting, you know, gets you into the ability to boot off an external drive. And then there's a command T to boot into target mode. And it's kind of a mess of just stupid command keys that we've, you know, been beaten into learning over the years. And so they want to unify that into kind of a boot manager thing, which is great. I think that's a great thing. But unfortunately, I think one of the things that they may be throwing the baby out with the bathwater is that they're getting rid of target mode. And the reason I think that's a bad thing is you have new Macs, particularly MacBooks, with the T2 chip on it. And the hard drives on these are not only not removable, they're not readable outside of the Mac because they're encrypted and tied to that T2 chip. So if if New York City allows us...
I like how it's like it's escalating.
That's true. This is dangerous stuff I'm talking about. Look at the high production values of this show. So yeah, you know, when your machine dies because it won't boot because something went wrong on the Mac, you were always able to boot into target mode, which essentially turned your Mac's hardware into a glorified external hard drive that you could plug into another Mac and recover. And if your partition is encrypted, you have to know the decryption key. So, you know, the security issues are kind of dealt with on that.
And this is not the same as target display mode.
Correct.
Which will allow you to use a Mac as just a display. And that went away years ago.
Right. Okay. So it's really become, if anything, more important with the advent of the T2 and locked in, soldered in storage solutions, that you be able to, when your Mac is not feeling good and recovery mode doesn't work and a lot of other things die, to get your data off your machine to be able to boot it into target mode. So Apple decided to get rid of that and to replace it with a Microsoft Samba server that will let you access your drive when nothing else on your machine works. Because the one hallmark of super high reliability systems is a Microsoft Samba server. When everything else goes poof up on your system, that is what you say, yes, rock solid. Forget the hardware level access. What I want is spawning off a Microsoft SMB server process to get access to my critical data that's tied and welded to a machine encrypted by the T2 chip. What could possibly go wrong?
Okay. But it could actually be done properly. It could be okay.
So one of the big problems... So yes, in theory, but so I hear what you're saying, Brian, and I appreciate kind of getting smacked for you should let people show you before you.
No. Hold on. I completely understand your trepidation here. I actually acknowledge, John, that we both do acknowledge the fact that it could go well. We just have concerns about it.
SMB also is notorious for not honoring a lot of resource fork information from Mac file systems, which is kind of critical to your data on a Mac file system. So they're all things they can that are addressable. This is all technically doishable, but it just on paper from a high level without seeing it in action and confirming it's awesome seems like a mysterious choice of decisions to be made about something this important. I hope I'm wrong, but this does not sound like a good choice.
Yeah, it doesn't. And do you know why? Do we understand why they're eliminating this?
I imagine it's something security-ish. Maybe it's tied with the Thunderbolt access and that there, you know, there's hacking that can happen to the T-Truth chip potentially through the Thunderbolt. But yeah, let's replace that, which is mission impossible level hackery, with the totally secure, never broken into Microsoft SMB process.
What could go wrong? But what if this is another one of those things? And you know, you and I have talked about this in the past, and we don't believe that this is the right way to do things from Apple's standpoint. What if this is another situation where Apple has the data and they know that no one's actually using it?
It's false. It's the same kind of false argument that was presented to me about Apple has the data about the pros, except they were 100% wrong about the pros, right? So let me assure you, pros use this all the time, a lot. Now, are there other ways to do something like this? Sure, but you're taking away a valuable tool in a pro's tool chest to do something, and not giving a better option, potentially giving a worse option for, you know, not seemingly great reasons. Although, to be fair, I haven't heard their reasoning. Maybe they have some kind of awesome reasoning and it might make sense. So I want to allow for, and I actually pray that I'm wrong on my kind of bad vibe from this, but, again, from a high level, without knowing the inside baseball of what's going on here, it just seems like a set of not great choices.
Yeah, I tend to agree. So we're going to have to see how it works out. We're just going to have to see. I also have trepidation on this. So we'll see. All right. Next, John.
So what did you like about the operating system stuff that came out from any of it, from the Mac OS, iOS, any of the other stuff? Any what were the standout features or things you really, you know, liked from the announcements, if anything?
So a funny thing happened on the way to the how's that old joke go? Funny thing happened to the way on the way to the to the Coliseum. Is that how it goes? Anyway, whatever. Funny thing happened the other day. Ken Ray, do you ever listen to Ken Ray show?
I don't think so.
Ken Ray is a brilliant podcaster. I love that guy. My favorite podcaster. He does it better than all of us.
Okay.
And he had me on Tuesday. I guess that'd be yesterday. Or at least we recorded yesterday. Maybe we recorded Monday. Whatever. He had me on this week to do a 10-minute segment. He does this thing that's it's essentially a podcast that's broken out over 5 days. So you 10, 12-minute segments. And so he asked me what my favorite announcement was. And I said, oh, yeah, knee-jerk response. The first thing that popped into my head was translation and dictation on device. And then I said, but I think that the real answer, even though it's the first thing that popped into my head, I think that the actual most important thing is Macs on ARM and Macs on Apple Silicon. So, but that... that was probably my absolutely favorite thing is that Apple is going to be doing a lot of this voice processing locally on our devices. It's huge.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder how they got to there. I suspect all the kind of server back end analysis of dictation, in some ways, this is what Tesla does with its AI, right? It sends everything back to the mothership for analysis, but then it makes kind of a small, more refined version of the AI, shall we say, neural net corpus that can run a bit on the car too. And it's a feedback loop and they keep refining that. So I wonder if all this analysis, even though some of it, you know, was a bit controversial in that Apple has been reviewing things we've said from Siri and whatnot, and they've kind of given us the option to opt out of that now. Over time have allowed them to make that refined version that will eventually run now on device. And I wonder if there's enough processing might on the device too, to kind of further that feedback loop, right? Where they could keep pushing out more and more refined versions of whatever, you know, is that corpus doing the dictation and whatnot.
Yeah. And we don't know. We just don't know. yet how they're doing it. But the fact that they are doing it is important in the privacy and security standpoint.
Yep.
So, yeah, that was my favorite announcement. I guess one thing I know that you want to talk about is the being able to use iOS and iPadOS apps on your Mac.
Well, I think that is the biggest thing. The ARM thing is really only furthering that macOS will now let you run natively iPhone and iPad apps is a big deal. And yeah, I was right about that in an article that I wrote in 2014 when I said we should be running this, because they could have been doing it since then, because they've always had an emulator in Xcode that let you basically test run these apps. So they could have done this, right? It would have been through emulation, potentially. But anyway, neither here nor there. As desk accessories was you know, and that's the way I view them. They're kind of like mini apps, which are most iPhone, at least a lot of the iPhone apps that I use. Like, there's no reason to use the iPhone version of Keynote when you have the full version of Keynote on your Mac. But there are a lot of iPad and iPhone apps that just don't have an equivalent on the Mac, so they'll be cool. And I think that's a huge, big deal. And the other thing that I wrote about back then that I think will happen, but you could, and it will happen at least in one way from day one, Brian, which is the interface obviously isn't going to be changed on those apps that run natively, right? There's still going to be like a Touch ID. You'll be able to use your mouse, but you can imagine that if you had a touchscreen Mac all of a sudden, it makes sense for you to use those apps with touch. And everyone that has an iPad and uses Sidecar will have exactly that. So you can have this weird thing where you're using Sidecar to extend your screen with your iPad, which is now a touch-enabled device, and you're running the iPad or iPhone app on your Mac, but you hold it on the screen that is your Sidecar iPad, and you now use the touch interface.
Yeah, but if you're looking down at your iPad so that you can actually touch stuff, what's the... You're not looking at your Mac screen.
I don't know. It depends how you run your Sidecar screen. Most people actually prop it up, you know, vertically to be just an extension of their actual Mac screens. And so they would actually reach out to, you know, to touch it. But the big deal is you can have the little bit of a touch interface for when it makes sense to do that. And you can obviously pull it down to if you're really using it a lot. But if it's running on your Mac, you can copy and paste between the two, right? You can maybe run Apple scripts or something between the two. So it just being in the Mac ecosystem allows you to leverage a lot more things with that same app running on the Mac, if you're kind of a power user. So there is advantage to that, and it will be the first baby step into, I think, getting a toaster fridge.
Yeah. Fair. I do hope that's coming. Here's a question for you. Will AppleScript make the port to ARM?
Oh, I don't see why it wouldn't.
I'll give you why would they kill Airport? Why would they kill target mode?
I apologize for my stupid, thoughtless statement. You are correct, sir. I guess the reason I made my misstatement is that I would think if something about that, it would have been out in the news by now, right? People have gotten their betas and installed it. So I would think I would hear a howl of protest, but I haven't. That's my reasoning.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, and let's just, you know what, John? Let's just go with that. It's like, no, because the news would already be there. So it's going to come. Everything is fine. Yay. Let's just go with that.
So what did you think about them using this as an excuse to finally increment this to become iOS 11?
macOS 11.
There's some Freudian slippage.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yes, I'm sorry that they finally incremented from macOS 10 to macOS 11 finally.
I it makes sense. It's the time to do it. You know, moving to a new processor, it just makes sense. And, you know, if you want to actually look at the past, the last time that we had that big change was when we knew. No, it wasn't when we moved to a new processor. Why did I say that?
No, it was not.
Why did I even say that? Yeah, hold on. Okay, now no one will know that I'm an idiot. It makes sense, though. Regardless, it's a time to do it. You know, we don't need to, with the 10.10.17 or 18 or 20 or right. 50 or whatever. Mac OS 11 it is. It is going to be a new era in a whole lot of ways. Giddy up.
They missed a big marketing opportunity by not calling this version Mac OS Spinal Tap. I just want to go out and say I'm really, really annoyed that they didn't. I don't think this is worthy of a number based on the last time the number was incremented, meaning the last time we went from a rinky-dink toy operating system to a real, you know, real Unix-based operating system. This is still very much the same operating system with, you know, the UI skinning is actually depressing. They're saying the UI is so updated. It is just kind of when they went from when they took all the joy out of the operating system, went from iOS 6 to 7 and went to that vapid mm-hmm. white whatever mm-hmm. garbage in iOS 7 and that we're still stuck with. This is they're doing that to Mac OS. It's just a new skin for new, you know, clicks, and they took all the color and joy out of every icon possible. So when they talk about the UI being rethought, it's a joke. But to your point, going through the numbering scheme was getting so ridiculous at this point, right? 10.13. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That they had to do it sometime, and when was there going to be a better reason than, you know, the change to in chippage, at least? Because yeah. The UI is there are barely any features okay. worth talking about.
But the change to UI is one thing. I think the sort of, you know, the App Store changes, being able to use iOS and iPadOS apps, and when coupled with the change in chippage. That's why
it's good enough to reason. I don't think there's, you know, there's no, you know, 10 commandment tablets on when thy shall and shall not, you know, iterate a major OS numbering scheme. So I think we're all fine there. I just pointing out that it's not actually as big a move as OS 10 was. But nonetheless, I agree with the increment because of the numberings. If anything, just to stop the silly numbering scheme.
I also want to point out, no one knows this, but and I don't know if Dave made a Spinal Tap joke on the Mac Geek Gab, but Kelly was right out the bat with Mac OS Big Sur. This one goes to 11. She wanted to do it. She's like, you know, let me do it. Please, can I do it? I'm going to write it up. It's like, no, Kelly. We're professionals,
right?
And we're going for proper, you know, SEO reach for our articles now. So, you know, but anyway, she was all over it.
As any good lover of Spinal Tap should be.
Absolutely and positively. All right, John, man, look, thank you very much for doing a show this week. It's been a busy week and I appreciate your time, brother.
Thanks so much. Had fun.
Absolutely. All right. Well, let me do... I'm never ready. There we go. And that is this week's Apple Context Machine. Boy, my voice changed. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, write me at acm@macobserver.com. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly, the basis by Boom, recorded just for us. And that is all for this week. And once again, thank you, Mr. Keat.
Thanks so much.